lots of moms out there. Happy Mother's Day to you. Let's give them a big round of applause. We love you. Moms, I hope your husbands and kids have something fun planned for you today. I remember a few years ago, my dad was here for Mother's Day, and I asked him when we were meeting for dinner and where we were going to go. And without a hint of irony, he said to me, "I don't know, Andy. Your mother makes all those arrangements." Your mothers and grandmothers, you mothers and grandmothers, you teach us a lot of important lessons. But the most important thing you teach is compassion. With gentle words, you soften our hearts. Through gracious deeds, you show us what it means to be kind. What would we men do without you mothers and grandmothers? It's a scary thought. We need you to remind us why we're here. As Rudyard Kipling observed, God could not be everywhere, and therefore he made mothers. We know that compassion begins at home. That's the first vital lesson that you moms teach us. Step one in learning to love like Jesus is learning how to love our bratty brother or our bossy grandmother. If we don't learn how to love those closest to us, we'll never learn how to love our neighbor. That has the makings of a solid Mother's Day message. Our family is a school of love, and our moms, and of course our dads too, you're the teachers. But today I want to talk about something different. I want to talk about the love that we show, or maybe that we fail to show, to people outside of our circle of family and friends. Jesus has a lot to say about that kind of love. His teachings are clear, and they're peppered with really powerful examples that stick in our minds. In Luke chapter 6, Jesus asks his disciples, "If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them." Jesus, of course, isn't saying that we shouldn't love our family, we shouldn't love our friends. He's saying that people who love God won't love only their family and friends. Jesus continues, "And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies. Do good to them. And lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High." Jesus' commandment to love your enemies is radical. Of course it is. It defies worldly logic. Actually, it contradicts the interpretation of the law that had been passed down by the Jews over many, many centuries. But Jesus is revealing something vitally important about the universe. He's lifting up the very highest form of love. It's love on the level of a PhD. If we're truly in tune with God's heart, we'll love people as he does, and that means our love for others will have no limitations. We'll love even our enemies. We'll love even those who hate us and seek to do us harm. We'll seek to bless them, knowing full well that they'll probably continue to curse us. Teachings like that sometimes frighten us. They certainly frighten me. They cause us to doubt ourselves. We have to wonder, who among us can love like that? Only a small minority of saints have hearts so big that they can bless their enemies. We need to understand here the context of Jesus' teachings. He's not laying out all the things that we have to do if we want to be part of God's kingdom. In other words, he's not telling us how to score points with God. Rather, Jesus is describing the kind of character that God wants us to have and the kind of character that we who love God finally will have when his kingdom is fully established. So there's hope in that hard message about loving your enemies. The point is, we shouldn't allow ourselves to be frightened by by the Lord's teachings or intimidated by these high standards that are set in God's kingdom. Instead, all of this should inspire us to ask a simple question. What baby steps can I take right now that would help me to grow in the character of Jesus? Thankfully, Jesus provides plenty of guidance for us. And by the way, what he has to say has been confirmed by every good mom through the ages. He tells us we should do what we can for people who are hurting. Who does Jesus have in mind when he says that? We don't have to guess about that. Jesus tells us quite explicitly who deserves our attention. His list includes those who are friendless, sick, those who are in prison. It includes those who've been neglected, abused, pushed aside by life. It includes the poorest of the poor. The Lord calls us to pay attention to such people, to put them on our radar screen, and to keep them there. And he doesn't expect us to solve all their problems. That's not his point. He calls us simply to do what we can with the limited resources and influence available to us to lift them up and bring them some relief. Any effort we make to do that is a baby step in the right direction. It's a baby step in the direction of becoming more like Jesus. And that's our purpose, to become shaped in the image of Christ. You ever notice what happens in the church when we start talking about helping the poor? It's kind of interesting. Almost invariably, the conversation turns to questions about how we can respond to homeless people begging on street corners and in parking lots. Should we give them money? What if they spend it on drugs or cigarettes? Is it better to give protein bars or maybe gift certificates from Burger King? Those questions actually are important. I don't mean to make fun of them. At the very least, we need to pay attention to people living on the streets. We should give them the respect of acknowledging their presence, of engaging them in conversation, offering them a smile, maybe a prayer. And by the way, speaking of protein bars, my wife keeps a stash of them in her car so she'll have something to give to people who are homeless. I know that because I raid that stash regularly when I feel the slightest concern that I might miss a meal. I bring all of this up to make a much wider point. The wider point is that when it comes to our personal response to poverty and to people who are suffering, our focus tends to be curiously narrow. Think of it this way. There are hundreds of thousands of extraordinarily poor people living within 20 miles of us right here. The schools in the neighborhoods are substandard at best. Many are living hand-to-mouth in overpriced, overcrowded apartment buildings. Crime rates in the neighborhoods are alarmingly high. We'd never tolerate the crime rate that we see down the hill from us in this neighborhood. The schools in their neighborhoods are substandard, and we understand all of that. We understand, furthermore, that the problem of poverty outside of our country is far, far worse. Worldwide, more than 1 billion people are struggling to live on less than $2 a day. 1 billion people. We all understand that by partnering with any number of Christian ministries or NGOs, we can make a huge difference for some of those people. We all know that. Yet where do our minds go when we talk about our response to the poor? We think of the few people that we encounter each week in our tiny circle of life who are begging on the streets. More to the point, we think about our own feelings of guilt and of how uncomfortable we feel when we try to decide whether to pull $2 out of our wallet or surrender the sandwich from our lunch or just keep walking. We don't talk about the thousands who are suffering in the micro communities all around us. We don't contemplate the vast opportunities that God has given us to leverage our not sure how to diagnose what's going on. We've never had more information about the world around us. Every day, we hear stories about the struggles of low-income people in our region, for example. We're bombarded with information. Moreover, we who live in the suburbs have never been richer. The range of opportunities open to most of us boggles the mind. Yet this rising tide of information and of wealth has not prompted robust action. It hasn't led to an increase in generosity. The statistics tell us that. It hasn't caused us to think more deeply and creatively about how we might help the poor. To the contrary, it has only served to dull our sensibilities. It's only magnified the tendency in our culture towards narcissism and self-promotion. Back in Jesus' day, the vast majority of people were poor. In fact, throughout all of human history, right up to the turn of the 19th century, well more than 90% of people worldwide were living in what we would regard as extreme poverty. Their houses were tiny. The floors of their homes were dirt. Of course, they had no electricity. They also had no running water, and much of the water they carried home was contaminated with nasty microbes. They cooked over fires in dark, smoky rooms. Their diet included little meat, very few fruits or green vegetables. Schools catered only to the rich. Most people were illiterate. Hospitals were almost unheard of. Opportunities for women and girls were severely limited. A large proportion of rich people got that way by exploiting slaves. It's important to keep all that in mind when you read the Lord's words in the 25th chapter of Matthew. I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Jesus identifies himself in this passage with each of the hurting people that he mentions. The one who was hungry, the one who was thirsty, and so on. In doing so, Jesus reveals to us three vitally important truths. And if you want to, you can open to the 25th chapter of Matthew and follow along. The first truth that he reveals to us has to do with the Lord's heart. He's telling us that he has a special love for people who have been pushed aside by the world. Christ loves us all, but he has a special regard for the poor and the oppressed. The Bible tells us that again and again from Genesis to Revelation. God stands with those people in solidarity and friendship. That simple word of assurance has sustained hundreds of millions of marginalized Christians over the past two millennia. It has inspired them to proclaim with Paul, if God is for us, who can be against us? The second truth has to do with our priorities. Our priorities. We who've been blessed in worldly terms need to get in line with the priorities that Jesus establishes in Matthew 25. That means lifting up those who are lowest, empowering the least. More than that, it means recognizing that our wealth has been entrusted to us by God. Why? So that we'll use it to grow his kingdom and be a blessing. The third truth has to do with our relationships with the people who are suffering. Jesus tells us that when we help such people, we're helping him. That's how closely he identifies with them. That's how much he loves them. This revelation provides us with a straightforward answer, at least one answer, to the question, why should we serve those in need? The answer is, because we love Christ. We don't do it for a thank you. We don't do it because it's fun, even though it usually is way more fun than we think it's going to be. And certainly we don't do it so that other people will applaud us and pat us on the back, not if our hearts are straight. We serve those in need because as we do so, we lift up the Lord Jesus himself. Mother Teresa was often asked what motivated her to serve the poorest of the poor. This response was typical for her. She said, "I see Jesus in every human being. I say to myself, this is hungry Jesus. I must feed him. This is sick Jesus. This one has leprosy or gangrene. I must wash him and tend to him. I serve because I love Jesus." I used to think that that provided enough of a reason to motivate us. We serve the poor simply because we love Jesus. That sounded wonderfully pious and holy and right-minded to me, I think, when I was in seminary. It was only after many years of serving among the very poor that I came to understand how wrong I was. Yes, we serve because we love Jesus, but we also serve because we love the ones we serve. Our love for Jesus should be accompanied by genuine love for those that he loves. The two should blossom together. I think that's part of what Jesus is signaling to us when he says, when you did it for the least of these, my brothers and sisters of mine, you did it for me. We never come right out and say that God alone could love the very poor. That would obviously be patronizing and condescending. But that's what we communicate to people, at least indirectly, when we say that we serve the poor because we love Jesus. Wouldn't it be better to say that we serve the poor because they're loved by God and they're created in his image, just as we are? Wouldn't it be more helpful to set a goal of loving people as Jesus does? Wouldn't it be more honest to admit that while we're finding it hard to love the stranger, we're working at it? Sometimes it takes a spiritual superstar, a Mother Teresa, to see Jesus in another person. But we all have the ability to love those who are hurting. We can cook a meal or offer a cup of cold water. We can take care of someone who's sick or visit somebody in prison. We can babysit for a single mom. We can drive a shut-in to a doctor's appointment. We can mentor an at-risk kid. We can drive to Mexico for a weekend and help to build an orphanage, or fly to the Dominican Republic to organize health clinics for Haitian cane cutters. We can all take baby steps towards the goal of loving like Jesus and becoming more like Jesus. I want to end today by giving you a pop quiz. And I was going to put this on the screen, but lo and behold, when we downloaded all the new information onto our new computers, PowerPoint was not included. I discovered that very recently. So you have to listen carefully. I'm going to give you a pop quiz. I'm going to ask you four multiple choice questions relating to worldwide poverty. And I think it's important for us as Christians to have at least a general sense of the challenges that we face in combating extreme poverty. So we're going to ask you to think carefully about these questions, and you might jot down your answers, and then I'm going to tell you the answers at the end. And don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand to let us know how you did. That's not going to happen. Question number one. In all low-income countries around the world today, how many girls finish primary school? How many girls finish primary school? Is it 20%? A. B. Is it 40%? C. Is it 60% of girls who finish primary school? Question number two. In the last 20 years, the The proportion of the world population living in extreme poverty has A, almost doubled, B, remained more or less the same, or has the proportion of the world living in extreme poverty almost halved? A, B, or C? Question number three. How many of the world's one-year-old children today have been vaccinated against some disease? What proportion of one-year-olds worldwide have been vaccinated against some disease? Is it 20% A? B, is it 50%? C, is it 80%? Last question, number four. Worldwide, 30-year-old men have spent 10 years in school on average. 30-year-old men have spent 10 years in school on average. How many years have women of the same age spent in school? Is it A, 9 years? B, 6 years? C, 3 years? The answer to question one is C. In all low-income countries across the world, fully 60% of girls today finish primary school. 60%. The answer to question two is C. In the last 20 years, the proportion of the world population living in extreme poverty has been cut in half. Did you hear that? The proportion of people living in extreme poverty in the world over the last 20 years has been cut in half. The answer to question C is C. Question three is C. 80% of the world's one-year-old children have been vaccinated against some disease. 80%. That's worldwide, Africa, Asia, everywhere. 80%. The answer to question four is A. Worldwide, 30-year-old women have spent an average of 9 years in school. They're almost caught up with men worldwide. Women, adult women worldwide have spent nearly as much time in school as men of the same age. Don't worry. If you are like most smart, educated, internet-connected people in the world today, you probably got at least three, if not four, of those answers wrong. We can assume that because of the extensive testing that has been done by the man who wrote those questions, Hans Rosling. When it comes to their understanding of world poverty, most of us have an excessively negative view of the world, and there are all kinds of reasons for that, starting with the media, of course. But there are lots of other reasons for that. We have an excessively negative view of what's going on around the world. We have not kept up with the vast changes that have taken place across our planet. We don't understand, for example, that the number of people living in extreme poverty has never been lower in world history, or that 80% of people worldwide now have access to electricity, or that the number of girls who receive a basic education has been rising dramatically, or that as a proportion of the world population, fewer people than ever are dying because of wars or violent crime or natural disasters. By the way, if you're interested in learning more, you might read Hans Rosling's remarkable book, Factfulness. It was recommended by Bill Gates. Rosling's core message is that in terms of the material well-being of our planet's 7 billion inhabitants, things are way, way better than we think they are. Why am I telling you this? In part because it's Mother's Day. We need to end with a smile today. But my main goal is to wake you up. It's to get you excited about the mission that Jesus has given to you of helping those who are still being left behind. The situation is not hopeless. Things are improving in ways that no But it's still true that more than 1 billion people worldwide are living on $2 or less a day. 1 billion people. 1 billion out of seven. Today, for the first time in history, the goal of eliminating the most extreme forms of poverty may be within reach. More than a billion people today align themselves with the Church of Jesus Christ. If only a quarter of those people got serious about the task, extreme poverty and the misery that it creates could become a thing of the past for the vast majority of people on the planet. It could happen within the lifetime of today's young adults. We Christians have the resources. We have the know-how. We have the necessary partnerships and extensive networks of support. The only question that remains is this. Do we dare to love as Christ loves? Will we allow our hearts to be broken for his sake and for the sake of those who are still living in the shadows? I'm going to end with a story. It's a simple story. It won't take long. Back in the 1980s, I took my first mission trip. I visited Nicaragua for 10 days with a group of Presbyterians. And we weren't there to do anything for the people. We were just interviewing people about the political situation. We tried to understand why so many people were so wretchedly poor. One day I was walking by myself along a beach, and I came across two young girls. Their clothes were filthy. Their hair was disheveled, but they were radiantly beautiful. They had with them a 5-gallon plastic bucket, and I asked them what they were doing, and they let me look inside. It was about a quarter full of rice and other scraps of food that they picked out of a nearby trash dump. They were heading home to give it to their mom. They let me take their picture. Even a sinner like me could see the Lord's face in their lovely faces. And that picture hung in my study for many years. It has since been replaced by the pictures of friends from the Dominican Republic. I kept it on the wall in front of my desk to remind me of our calling, a calling that is summarized so graciously for us by Paul in his instructions to his protege, Timothy. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. Let's pray. Gracious God, you've created us to be instruments of your love, to be your hands and feet, because you're not here right now, physically present. You've given us your church to be your representatives and to continue your work. So we want to glorify you in all that we do, to make the best possible use of the gifts you've given us. So help us not only to empathize with people who are suffering, but also to do what we can for them, to lift them up, to stand with them, to pay attention to them. Lord, the opportunities before us are huge. Inspire your church to stand with the very poor and to work towards that day when none